Hello and welcome back to the Sense of Place podcast. Now in today's episode I have a chat with Tom Chivers. He's a writer, arts producer and mudlark with a background in poetry from South London. Now Tom has released two pamphlets and two collections of poetry, but more recently in 2021 he released his debut non-fiction book London Clay, which can be described as a mix of geology, history, folklore, memoir, which explores the landscape and city of London. Now, as I mentioned, Tom is also a mudlark and he's actually completing a PhD on mudlarking. So just before we get into today's episode, I'll give you the quick rundown of things we chat about. So we start off with a look at Tom's book, London Clay, and why he wanted to write it, as well as the important role Lost Rivers play in London's geology. The conversation actually ends up being more talking about his mudlarking. We look at what a mudlark actually is, what he is hoping his PhD will uncover, some of his best and worst finds, and much more. So we'll crack on with the episode now, and I really hope you enjoy it. We'll start with your book, London Clay. So that obviously explores London's deep past, the geological layers of it. Given you've got a background in writing and poetry, what was it that led you to want to write a book that explores it through a geological lens?
Well, I think the origins of the book are really a project that I did for a climate change arts organisation called Cape Farewell. This is going back about 10 years. And they wanted me to explore landscape and the city. And my kind of first instinct was to go back to something I'd been interested in a long time ago, when I was a teenager, in fact, which is the Lost Rivers of London. And so I began by modifying a street map of London using the Lost Rivers, the courses of the Lost Rivers. But once I'd done that, I realized that it was kind of incomplete without also registering the geology, because, of course, the rivers are dependent on the geology and then, of course, create the geology. They're mutually constitutive. So I started basically drawing over the street map using coloured highlighter pens and things like that, the geology of London. And that really is where everything began. I started to spot all these moments of or places of kind of conjunction where stories about the city's development started to emerge from the actual geology. And every chapter in London Clay starts from a particular place on that map and is about bringing together the sense of the physical landscape beneath our feet with some of the stories and histories and even just urban myths that inhabit the city.
I mean, it's a bit like part memoir, the book, isn't it? It ends up weaving your personal journey into sort of the physical journey as you're exploring London. Was that intentional, or did just that end up being a result of your research and it just sort of all tied in nicely?
To be honest, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, there was always that intention to bring in my own lived experience, because the idea of bringing together the kind of deep past and history with how we live in the city today, it required me to be a kind of character in the book. What I didn't realise was just how much I'd be drawn into thinking about my own past. That's something that sort of crept in as the book went along. In fact, there was even the very final, it's not the chapter, but the coda of the book, which is all about my late mother and her being part of the campaign to save the Rose Theatre in Bankside in the 80s. That wasn't in the plan at all. I was supposed to be writing something completely different about the Thames Barrier, and that never even got in. So yes, I knew I would always feature in it, but just not quite as deeply as it turned out.
Yeah. And I mean, do you think the geology of London's influenced the way that it has been laid out, where we've settled? Do you think that's played a big part?
Yeah, it's absolutely fundamental. I mean, that's kind of the core point of the book, really, is trying to encourage people to think about the city as being developed in kind of concert with the natural landscape, not just kind of laid above it like it's some kind of tabula rasa, but really working with it. So for example, the most obvious example is the Romans. They founded London in around 47 AD on an area of kind of dry, fairly firm ground north of the river, in what is now the city of London, across two gravel hills. And these are two hills that were formed as part of a terrace of the natural river terrace of the Thames. It was also somewhere where there was a fresh water stream, the River Walbrook, running in between. They couldn't really have set it up on the south bank, for example, because the south bank of the Thames was much marshier. And that's all to do with the geology of London. It's a very kind of persistent feature of how London has developed throughout the ages. I mean, that's the Romans. If you then can skip forward to, say, the Victorians, who are responsible for huge amounts of the kind of terraforming, the kind of changing of the landscape, and in some ways kind of flattening things out, banking the rivers, sewerizing things, and so on. They were still effectively working with the geology of London. You know, Bazalgette's famous sewer system, for example, is built directly over the network of tributaries running into the River Thames. So lost rivers such as the Fleet and the Walbrook and the Tyburn and so on, they all became part of the Victorian sewer system. And even today, we're still living with the natural materials of the city. That's kind of the foundation of London. Once you take a geological view of London, you start to see how the rivers are not this kind of simple layer that you can just kind of plop down on the map of London, but they are always interacting with they are formed by and also form the surrounding geology of the city. You really can't extricate the rivers from the geology, from the clay and the sand and the gravel and the alluvium and all the other geological materials that underlie the city. So they're all really part of the same thing. And it's an incredibly complex. London has a very kind of basic river valley geology, but within that you then also get a lot of geological anomalies. And even today, when engineers are breaking ground for some new development, they will often find things that they weren't expecting to find, particularly geological layers that that hold water. That's a particular challenge to engineers. It's all part of the same system. A lot of rivers are inextricable from the wider geology of the city.
Now, before we started recording, we were talking about you doing a PhD in mudlarking.
Yes.
And I said it almost seems like it led on nicely from the book. It just seemed a natural progression. So would you mind telling the listeners how you got into that? And I mean, for starters, actually, what is mudlarking? Because some people might not be aware of what it actually is.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Very simply, mudlarking is the practice of going down to a river or a stream and looking for objects of interest at low tide. And mudlarking is very much associated with the River Thames. There are other places that do the mudlark, but the Thames is the sort of alma mater of mudlarks. And that's because it's tidal. It has a huge tidal range, 7 or 8 meters. And that means that the riverbed is exposed twice a day. And when it's not exposed, it's being kind of shuffled around by the currents. So what you find when you go down there are all the kind of historic objects, the waste effectively of London, a major, major global city over the last 2000 years plus. So mudlarks like myself, I've been doing it for about 3 years. We can go down and on any given day, we might find some Tudor medieval jewellery, fragments of Roman pottery, really anything that might survive in that mud, you can pick out. And it's an activity that has exploded in interest over the last 3 or 4 years, I would say. Been a lot of media attention, some best-selling books have been written about it. And then when COVID-19 hit and we were all trapped indoors, it became one of those things that people pick up a little bit like, baking sourdough bread or something. And for me, because I live by the River Thames in southeast London, and at the time I was living in a two-bedroom flat with to children, to young children, with no garden. So the river became this kind of garden for me and for my kids. And that started that relationship with the Thames foreshore that ended up with me becoming a licensed Thames mudlark, because it is something you have to have a special permit from the Port of London Authority to do. And then last year, an opportunity came up to study for a PhD on the topic of mudlarking within the School of Geography at Queen Mary University of London, collaborating with the Museum of London Archaeology. And I thought I would go for it. I'd been a long time, 15, 20 years out of university, but I felt like it was a great opportunity to explore this practice further and to really kind of immerse myself in the intellectual life of doing a PhD. So that is kind of where I am now. I'm studying all those strange people like myself who go down and get muddy on the foreshore.
So what is the sort of end goal with the PhD? What are you hoping your research will uncover?
Well, it's an area that is, despite the fact that it's actually quite popular and also has this incredibly long history going back to the late Georgian period in terms of people going down to mudlark for their livelihoods, it's not really being looked at all by academics. So I'll be the kind of first person, academic person, kind of on the ground with mudlarking, which means that I have this huge remit. I can really study anything within the practice that interests me. And I'm being quite ambitious with it. I really want to just better understand, first and foremost, why do people go down there? What is it they get from the river, quite apart from the historical objects? What is the value of mudlarking to the people who do it? What's also the value to the wider understanding of history? Particularly, I think, to that sense of democratizing history. Because the thing that's really striking about mudlarks is that, they come from all walks of life. There are people there who, of course, have a kind of professional or academic interest in history or something like that, but there are lots of people who don't. And we all go down there and with this kind of democratic community of people who find stuff. And that stuff tells us stories about history in a different way to the way that history might be engaged with through books or even through popular history such as on TV. And we get to hold this stuff. We find it, we have that magical connection with the past that you have when you find an object fresh from the mud, as it were. And then we take it back home and we interpret it. But we're all amateurs. So there's something really important there, I think, about the democratization of history and understanding about our city that I want to try and capture through my research.
I've done it two times because I went on one of those molar courses, where you can go, it can be the frog.
Yes.
But unfortunately I moved away from London, so I never got to keep going with it. But definitely see the appeal. Something about you're like the first person to find this thing and touch this thing after years of it being buried. And also just, it's just quite therapeutic being down by the water, isn't it? It's quite nice.
Yeah, I think that therapeutic element's really important as well. I want to try and capture that too. The title of my PhD is In the Flow of Things. And the title is kind of a deliberate pun because, of course, the river flows, but also objects flow. They flow in and out of the city through global trade routes, connected with very complex, and in some cases very challenging, history to do with colonialism. But then also the mudlarks themselves, they flow across the surface of the river. And there's also that sense of being in a flow state. So it's a bit like being in the zone, doing something that is kind of so immersive that the stresses of daily life seem to just evaporate. And that's certainly my experience of going down to the foreshore. And I've met many people who are mudlarks who do the same, who use it in a sense as therapy or kind of mindfulness, trying to process trauma or just, just escapism at a more basic level. So I want to try and capture that. And also, connect that with other forms of engaging with the natural world that we're encouraging. I think also it's important to focus on the Thames foreshore itself, because as much as mudlarking has been kind of ignored by academics and generally, the Thames foreshore is also a really overlooked space. There's a huge amount of acreage. I'm not quite sure what it is if you added it all up together. Low tide, but it's a huge amount of space, kind of natural, well, natural-ish. Maybe we can talk about that later. but naturalish space within this incredibly busy, you know, highly populated city. And it's somewhere that we can access. It is private land owned by the Port of London Authority mostly, but it is, you know, there is kind of open access to people to go down there, and for those who have a permit to then search for objects. So I think there's something really important about studying that space and trying to understand, you know, what are some of the challenges for it? You know, can it always be an open space? Can people be encouraged to spend time down there? So these sorts of questions around place are also really important for my research.
No, it sounds like really good, important research. It's actually surprising nobody's done this before. Yeah. Nobody's researched it before, isn't it? So
yeah.
No, that's really
it's interesting. Whenever I say I'm doing a PhD on mudlarking, you know, it can elicit laughter.
Really?
Because, you know, it does seem like such a ridiculous thing to do. It's like doing a PhD in tiddlywinks, because it is. I mean, the archaeologist Ivor Noel Hume, who was also a mudlark, this is back in the 50s, described it as a strange hobby. And he's right, it is very strange. When you look at mudlarks from the riverbank and you don't really know what they're doing. I mean, you're looking at grown adults, and, you know, for the most part, you know, ankle deep in mud. It's a very odd thing to do. But, you know, as I hope to prove within the research, I think there is an importance there, both in terms of, as I said, this kind of democratization of history, and also in terms of accessing space and kind of making that space public. So I hope by the end of the project, you know, it won't be listing quite so much laughter and shock and maybe a bit more kind of understanding.
Yeah, the thing is, though, it kind of just gives regular people a chance to get their hands on some history. And if you weren't trained as an archaeologist, you're never going to get to do that, are you?
So yeah.
It just gives you that chance to go down there and feel a part of it.
Yeah,
it's funny. Yeah. I'm actually surprised people laugh, but I guess I'm not laughing because I'm a nerd and I would enjoy that too. So
yeah, and I think it's also absolutely fine for people to laugh. I mean, it is strange, and, you know, rather than trying to kind of assimilate us as a sort of a, you know, like authorized normal activity, it's okay to be a bit odd. It's okay to be strange. So that's how I feel about it. And actually, the one of the wonderful things about mudlarking, because often it's associated with solitary nature. It's, you know, something you do on your own. The kind of archetypal vision of a mudlark is, you know, a single figure surrounded by mudflats. The reality is that it's an amazing community, a very supportive community, that exists particularly online. So a lot of mudlarks share their finds on Instagram and other social media networks, and that kind of informal online networking means that we're constantly building our knowledge of the historical objects that we find and about the foreshore itself. Even just last night, I was having a long chat via direct message on Instagram with a brilliant mudlark who is a bit of an expert on jewellery and very small things like gems and beads. And she was giving me lots of advice about some new items that I'd found in the river. So it's an amazing way of kind of learning through a community of people rather than more traditional book learning.
Yeah, definitely. When you are mudlarking, do you have a certain style? Because I did read about that in Laura Makelam's book, that some people dig, some people just use their eyes. And, you know, it's better to just let the river reveal the treasures that it's got. So would you dig or just use your eyes to find the treasures?
Yeah, this is a really controversial point within the mudlarking community, and it's also related to the current situation with licensing, which is that the Port of London Authority has actually paused the new permit scheme. So you can still mudlark if you have existing permit, but you cannot get new ones. And partly it's to do with this question of how people are mudlarking. You know, when mudlarking first became relatively popular, I suppose, back in the late 70s and the early 80s. It was an activity that really required you to dig. So the Society of Thames Mudlarks and Antiquarians, as they're called, there's about 50 of them. They have special licenses where they can dig much deeper on the foreshore than the normal mudlarks. And I think, you know, according to my research anyway, that's largely because back in the 70s and the 80s, the river was much muddier, because there was less river traffic, and particularly there weren't the Thames Clippers taxis going back and forth. and the engines of those boats creates very large wakes, and those wakes, and we see this as mudlarks whenever we go down to the foreshore, those wakes effectively clear off the top, they wipe away the top layer of mud. So the kind of modern breed of mudlarks, people who've started doing it in the last 10, 15 years or so, they can access object without having to dig. So that's partly one of the reasons why people like Lara, for example, have a kind of an eyes-only practice. There are others who scrape using trowels. So, for example, I do scrape in areas that I'm permitted to scrape. And there are people who dig down to, I think it's 5 or 6 centimetres, sorry, 5 or 6 inches into the foreshore. But these are, you know, these are kind of political things in a way. And it's something that, you know, without wanting to say too much now, it's something I want to look into in my research.
Yeah, absolutely. Best and worst find that you found down there?
Okay, yeah. I don't get being asked about the worst find. That's interesting.
I bet it's sewage or something awful like that.
I've got something in mind, actually. I've got something in mind. A couple of things. The best find, I do get asked quite a lot. It's hard to beat a medieval ring. I found a medieval ring with the stone still set in it.
Oh, wow. And
this is actually when I just started to, you know, it was a couple of years ago now, I just started doing it really, and I found this beautiful pewter ring. It dates to the late 14th, early 15th century, so roughly the time of Chaucer, which kind of excites me as a bit of a medieval literature nerd. But what's interesting about this ring is that it seems to have been twisted. So the band of the ring doesn't really look like a ring, it looks more like a pendant because the band has been twisted. And I think it's been twisted deliberately rather than, you know, kind of squashed by a stone or something, which of course begs the question, you know, who has deliberately twisted the ring and then thrown it into the river? You know, it like a lot of these objects, it triggers various kind of creative imaginings in your own mind about the moment of deposition. In terms of the worst object, I mean, obviously there's a lot of waste in the river. All of the stuff that we find is, in effect, historic waste. But the big difference is that what we're putting in the river now is very plastic-based. So I would say possibly the worst thing is the thing I find a lot of, and that's vapes. There are an awful lot of vapes, probably hundreds of thousands of vapes in the River Thames. And there are certain spots by dint perhaps of currents, I'm not sure, where you get the same brand of vape turning up, you know, 20, 30 sometimes in one single visit. So, yeah, worst objects, I'd say vapes.
Yeah, that's funny you mentioned vapes, because a little thing on Countryfile came up about them the other night, saying, you know, that they seem to be everywhere now and they're actually worse than cigarette butts.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's quite ironic because they were sort of promoted as, oh, these are better than cigarettes, and that they're just far worse for the environment and probably your health as well, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I have to say I'm an occasional vapor myself, but you know, they are terrible things to throw in the river because A, they're plastic, and B, they contain batteries. So, you know, they're potentially long-term quite toxic for the river. I mean, I would say that, you know, because we do beat ourselves up quite understandably and rightly about the amount of plastic pollution in the world generally. But I think it's also fair to say that even before plastics, we were throwing toxic materials into our natural environment.
No, you're right.
What we find an awful lot of in the River Thames is lead, and lead is toxic to the river. Some of my best finds are also lead, so it's, you know, it's this strange paradox where we're looking for stuff that is effectively toxic and polluted.
No, you're right, actually, because it's, I suppose all that stuff's got the element of time to it, so it seems exciting and interesting, but
yes,
you know, maybe one day people will be interested in finding bits of fate. Yeah. I mean, because you've got the clay pipes, they're everywhere. They're like the new clay pipe, I guess, right?
Exactly. And the thing that people are always interested in with the clay pipes is, you know, what's the decoration? And the decoration is effectively just branding. So in, you know, 200 years, 500 years, 1,000 years, will we be picking up vapes and being kind of, you know, interested in cataloguing the various different brands of vape? Quite possible.
I reckon someone will.
Yeah.
The Thames has got very unique properties about it, hasn't it? It's anaerobic, so lacks oxygen, so that helps preserve a lot of the finds. I mean, is that pretty rare to come across in other rivers? Because that just seems like the hotspot for mudlarking. Is there anywhere else people do it?
Yeah, I mean, the conditions of the Thames are particularly good for for find, just really because its tidal and it's such a major historical river. So there are other historical rivers that you think might, there might be these sorts of finds, the Seine in Paris, for example, but it's too far inland. You know, the Thames is close enough to the sea for it to be tidal and have that kind of tidal patterns of erosion and deposition and so on. So it does have particularly good conditions. And you're right, it has this anaerobic mud. It's very kind of clay heavy alluvium, which keeps finds really well. And so you'll often find things in the river that come out looking, immaculate. It's really quite surprising. You also find even organic materials such as leather coming out in pretty good condition. But the problem is, it's a little bit like that scene from one of the Indiana Jones movies where they break into a mummified body. As soon as it's exposed to the air, it kind of crumbles away. So if you do find leather finds, leather objects, and wooden objects as well, they do tend to deteriorate quite quickly once they've dried out. But even there, mudlarks are always sharing various kind of processes that would help to conserve these objects. There's also a kind of flow of information between mudlarks and more kind of professional organizations such as the Museum of London and Museum of London Archaeology as well. So objects that are of particular historic interest are reported, or should be reported at least, to the museum, and some of them are actually conserved professionally. You asked about other rivers. There are other places where mudlarking happens. I mean, you could mudlark in any river or stream. I know that, for example, there are small rivers in Yorkshire where people mudlark and find bits of old pottery. Internationally, I know that on the east coast of America in particular, there are places where what we probably call vintage, because they're not that old, historic objects are found on the beaches there. Somewhere called, I think, like Dead Horse Bay or Horseshoe, something like that, Bay, and near New York, where there are lots of mudlarks. So yeah, it is an international hobby, but certainly the Thames is the place to be.
Yeah, I suppose it's just got so much history behind it, hasn't it? So it's always been a hub.
It has, yeah.
Have you ever found anything made from leather or wood?
I have, yeah. I've found various things. I mean, they're probably not my best finds, but I'd say one quite exciting early find was to find a Georgian shoe buckle that was still attached to the leather upper of the shoe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really magical, actually. There's just something about, because we find leather shoe soles all the time, and then we also find Georgian buckles, but to find them still attached for some reason just really kind of hit the spot for me. And actually, the other leather item that I really prize is the sole of a child's shoe. And I just remember the moment when I pulled it out of the mud. Mm. I saw the tip of it, and I thought, that's just a leather shoe. We find loads of those. And when I pulled it out, it was absolutely minuscule. And there was just something really magical about finding something that, my 2-year-old could fit. It was really kind of spine tingling, actually, that moment.
It's so personal, isn't it, a shoe? I think I would feel the same by finding something like that. You think, what happened to them? How did that end up in there? And yeah. I know what you mean about it gets the imagination going, because you find these objects like the ring, you say it's twisted, but why? And
yeah,
you kind of make stories. And I mean, that's, to me, that seems part of the joy and fun of it too. Just, you never will really know, but you can just sort of try and imagine what it might have been.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think it sort of brings me back to my book, London Clay, as well, because that also has that sense of wanting to talk about the more sort of ephemeral memories and kind of urban myths and imagination kind of driven information about the city, as well as thinking about some of the more scientific ways, such as geology, for example, in which we can understand place, and bringing those two things together, kind of holding them at the same time and saying, that's okay. We don't have to choose. We don't have to say we're either, scientists, or we are kind of, just making things up. The two have an interrelation. And certainly one of the powerful things about finding these mudlarked objects is imagining who kind of last touched that, who last wore that. It's why things like shoes and jewelry, dress accessories, things that were worn on the body, I think are a particular power. They have an almost talismanic power sometimes. And I know that some people do kind of treasure their model art objects in that way.
Definitely. Best of luck with the PhD. Sounds really, really interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah. And regarding the book, London Clay, I mean, where could people find that if they want to have a read of it?
Well, it's kind of widely available. It's in paperback now. And it's available at all good bookshops and the usual horrible online places as well. Horrible but convenient online places. And I'm always, out and about doing events as well. So, if anyone's listening and wants to find out more, I have a website, thisisgillgib.com, with various mudlarking and London Clay related events that I'm doing.
Well, thank you for your time, Tom.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
So there we have it. Hopefully that's inspired you to get out and about and maybe get down to the foreshore if you can and have a look. If you'd like to find out more about Tom's book London Clay or any of his other work, please head over to thisisyogic.com. And for anything else Sense of Place podcast related, please head over to senseofplacepod.com. So that's all from me, and I will speak to you again soon.